Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times says, "If Looks Could Kill is one of those zany capers that come along occasionally to remind us of the pleasures of wretched excess. The movie tells a bizarre story about middle Americans trapped inside the Byzantine intrigues of Europe, and is perhaps the only film I can recall in which a mad economist traps an entire Detroit high school French class in an iron cage suspended above a cauldron of boiling gold. At first, it appears the movie is only going to be another one of those brain-damaged caper ripoffs in which boring people do stupid things at half the pace of real life. Then it turns on the supercharger and transforms itself into the kind of hallucinatory fable in which a tiny woman wears a gold whip around her neck and uses it to reduce foreign ministers into lumps of placation."
New York Times, Mr. Stephen Holden. "The film's fatal flaw is the charmless performance of its star, who displays so little enthusiasm that in looking for signs of life, the viewer's attention is likely to drift to those weirdly plucked Mr. Spock eyebrows. Mr. Greco's problems can be blamed partly on the director, Mr. William Dear, who plunks him into some potentially funny situations, but then leaves him stranded without a clue as to how to proceed."
Check it out! Who's that tuxedo-wearing guy in the turbocharged red sports car? It's Richard Grieco from Mobsters or 21 Jump Street, putting pedal to the metal as Teen Agent?
That is a typo.
Typo on the back of the box? That's yes, right. How yes. much quality went into this?
Michael,
we're doing so well.
Michael Corbin. In this funny, fast-moving spy spoof, also starring Linda Hunt, Roger Rees, and Gabriel Anwar. Needing a class credit for graduation, Michael, Grieco, goes to Europe with the French Club for what he hopes will be a brazen babe safari. Instead, he's mistaken for a top super spy, loaded up with lots of high-tech espionage gear and given an awesomely outfitted car. He's having the time of someone else's life. Now, all he has to do is save Europe and graduate from high school. No problem. That's If Looks Could Kill. On trial.
Cue music.
It's on trial.
Who are you?
My name is Bond.
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 James Bond.
What are you doing here? Looking for shells?
No, I'm just looking.
As you can see, I have no problem with you.
This is not what I
you sound like a cop to me.
Who's your connection?
Well, that she wants is to scare the living daylights out of
Mr. Peckish, is it?
Where is Peckish?
Where's Peckish? Where's Peckish?
He died rather suddenly, poor chap.
How did he die? Your contact? Not well.
He fell into a pulverizer at the works.
I think they were on their way to a funeral.
You okay, James? Where's your butler friend?
Oh, he blew a fuse.
Plenty O'Toole.
My name's Jonathan Alexandrados, the judge of this particular jury. Trial.
By all accounts, you are the jury and the,
I'm the judge.
And the, judge. Yeah. So and the executioner.
if it's necessary.
Right, right. And who else is here? Jason's here.
I'm here. This is Jason and Vyshenik. I not only am I defending this movie, but I chose it. Put it on trial for the defense. Also, I am co-defendants with my usual longtime co-defendant, Dr. Tracy Beeler.
And I am in a mood.
Oh, dear God.
I love when you're in a mood, Tracy. It means we're going to win it.
Means we can't have sex.
I'm not sure whether that goes in our favor or not, but I'm going to introduce myself, John Rice, for the prosecution. Next to me is Mr. Brian Kim, co-prosecutor.
Hello. I am in a mood, John.
Oh, my God. Brian's in a mood. Brian's
in a mood for a Slurpee.
That's about the tone of this movie, actually, so that's perfect.
Yeah. Starting in already, huh? Not even through the introductions.
There comes the needle. Hi.
All right, great. Well, I'll hear opening statements from the defense.
Before we go into the nuts and bolts of this movie, I want to throw something on the table. This movie, it is a comedy. It is a parody of the 007 movies that, I'm going to say, has a lot more charm and a lot more nuance than the second and third Austin Powers movies, which does the same thing, but beats you over the head with it. Nice send-up. I'm sorry, Dad.
No, I would agree. And it has a 90s sensibility that I think the judge would really appreciate. It's a 1991 film starring Richard Grieco of 21 Jump Street. Apparently now the only star, or at least the one co-star of 21 Jump Street who doesn't beat up women. So that's something right there going for it.
Find it our favorite or you're sexist.
Well, I may very well be sexist. all right, great. Well, what's the other side to this?
All right, Brian, do you want to start talking about 21 Jump Street in Europe, or shall I?
You can go ahead.
If Looks Can Kill is about a secret agent with a knapsack and about as much emotional intelligence as a 14-year-old can, like, think of, it's the perfect kind of YA movie for, like, you're going to be looking at your phone the entire time, except they didn't have cell phones in 1991, so how do you get through this in 91? Don't really know. Mm-hmm. It's
profuse
not as...
masturbation, I assume.
That's how the rest of us did it. My daddy and his daddy before.
Well, I'm really glad I didn't watch the movie.
Well, thankfully we have cell phones now to put in our hands instead of something else. Is that too blue?
No. Come on, I say worse things in the intro to this. So should we... How would you like us to proceed?
All right, well, what I'd like to do first is just kind of get a sense of the three acts of this thing. So let's just go straight up plot and let me get a sense of what this is about.
All right. So we start, if I may, if there's no objection, just... We start with a graduation scene that is not in real time. Yeah, that's a Heaven's Gate reference. And Richard Corbin, Richard Grieco, but his name is Corbin, he realizes at graduation day, they let him walk, which they'll do, and they give him all the paperwork, but the paperwork says, for this to be real, you have to go to summer school for French class.
Okay.
And he's very upset about that. His father gives him a very good speech that foreshadows the entire plot and themes of this movie about not having follow-through. You never follow through with anything. You always just want to go get stoned with your friends. You never do anything. His father is then forced to send him to France with the French club as the only way to get his French credit and graduate high school.
So the French class goes to France?
Yeah, because yes. It's French club. The French teacher's not going to be there. The only way to get the credit is to send him to France.
And I would like to add in that his father is stern but loving. Like, it's a much better kind of father. Don't shake your head at me. Father-son relationship. It's a kindly sort of, you know, shaping of his son versus a berating of his son. You can tell there's real affection and love there.
All right, well, this is a key thing for me. I got to decide if this father-son relationship is affectionate or not.
Well, Your Honor, could I just read the notes that I took while watching this scene?
I'd be glad to hear them, yeah.
The direct quote that I have here is, "Asshole dad making fun of his failing son." That pretty much sums up their relationship.
I
feel
kind of
very
agree with
little
that.
Affection between the father.
It's like it's cartoonishly brought out when the affection comes out. There's like it's like 80% lecture and then like 20%. Ah, you mug, I still love you.
I
would like to also point out that while the father is lecturing his son in this beginning scene, that he's walking around the house with a dry paint roller. He's not
he's
painting anything.
He's a working class guy. He
but
wants
it's the
better
evening.
For his son.
Do you suspect abuse?
Like,
there's no abuse.
What is this paint roller for? As a playwright, right. Would you give an actor a prop that they are clearly not going to use?
Well, that is the rule of theater. You don't introduce a paint roller in the
he
first act.
He paints something by the third act.
No, he doesn't.
No, he doesn't.
You can't
one might say
he is
theater.
Never seen again.
Okay.
One might say
okay,
that he is helping paint his son's future by giving him this tough love. And look,
just like my dad was helping to build my waistline by whipping me with a belt.
He wasn't hitting him with a paint roller.
He was
well, we
it.
Don't know, do we?
Yes, we do.
That's what you're
we
saying.
Know.
We don't know.
We know.
We don't know.
All right. Well, it's not in the text anyway. So he doesn't...
And I want to say he's a man of his time. The father.
All right.
Okay. He has trouble showing his caring and loving love for his son because he himself did probably was not given the model of that, and he's doing the best he can. So he gives him the stern lecture like his father before him, but unlike his father before him, he gives the, you know, but you could do better. I love you.
I would like to.
Quite touching, actually, the relationship between those
I'd like to point out that the father one disappears like right after the airport scene, so he done by act one, never comes in again.
As the best fathers do.
And two, this speech is full of the kind of wooden, meaningless dialogue that this entire movie is full of. Because I wrote down some quotes. I'm going to read you four
lines
from this thing.
For the record, the crackling you hear in the background is the defense cracking open another mini bottle of wine. Please.
Look, we need to drink through this.
The judge will now take a sip of.
Yes. All right, so here is, you know, a very important chunk from the father-son speech.
Okay.
Sits him down at the kitchen table with his dry paint roller, has the arm around him. All and right, Richard Grieco says, is this the no follow-through speech? And the dad says, yes. You know what your problem is? No. No follow-through. This is the only level of dialogue you can come to expect from this movie. Mm-hmm. Like, the top jokes that I have written down here are punchlines like, don't count on it. Geez, talk about peer pressure. And if we don't have a plan, we're out of luck. That's it.
Okay, all right. Well, dialogue aside, I mean, my question is still, and maybe this is the last we'll explore this, but is this a relationship between father and son that is hurtful emotionally to the son?
Absolutely not.
No.
This
he
is
sends
a relationship
him to
that allows his son to thrive.
Does he pay for the trip?
Yes, he does.
Yes, and that
begrudgingly.
But he does it. He very well could have said, you know what? You're a fuck up and you never follow through. I'm not spending money on sending you to France. Get a fucking job
and
do it yourself.
Come fake paint with me. But he said no.
Right. He says, I got to send you to France. You're going to France because you failed out of high school. Right. Of course he's angry.
All right, well, what's the other side's take on that?
Well, of course he doesn't want him to paint with him. He's not painting anything. They didn't think that far ahead.
Okay. All right.
Also, I think I might understand a little bit of the father's frustration at his 28-year-old son only graduating high school. So perhaps there's a...
It was unspoken, but he graduated from Beverly Hills 90210.
Yeah,
so he was not the oldest member. That was Andrea Carteris. He was 45.
All right, fair enough. So let's go into the sort of middle of this thing. What's next? You guys start it up, please.
So we then get to see the villains of this movie, who I really didn't even catch their names. Linda Hunt was one of them. She was the small person. But then
Starenko,
who just looked like kind of like Kyle MacLachlan to me, to be honest. He had that sort of vibe to him. And essentially they kill this really top agent named Blade. Blade? I think it was Blade.
Yes,
right?
Blade.
Yeah, Blade.
Not that one.
Not the Blade that you
think.
Okay, that
would be awesome, though. What a movie that would be.
But another secret agent named Blade.
Okay.
And so the people who sent Blade over to infiltrate the villains then need to send a new agent whose name is Michael Corbin, which just happens to be Richard Grieco's character's
Uh-oh.
Name. Hence the mix-up.
Okay. Gotcha. Oh, so it's a mistaken identity he's thrown into this.
So exactly. When they kill the real agent, Michael Corbin, at the airport, Richard Grieco somehow winds up with his first class ticket and then gets picked up at the airport and
given
thrust into this
espionage.
And if I may address the villains, because I think this is important,
because
again...
Please.
This is a send-up to the 007 films.
Uh-huh.
Right now, Linda Hunt's character, she is an assassin, his second in command.
Yeah.
She has like a gold chain that comes right off her neck, and she uses it as a whip to strangle people, kill people. It's an obvious reference to the female Russian agent in the second Bond movie, From Russia with Love.
Okay.
Right? There
are
parallels right there.
Right.
And Starenko's whole plan, I know we didn't get into it, but his whole plan is pretty much a Goldfinger plan.
Okay.
So right here,
steal Fort Knox.
He's stealing gold.
Oh, okay.
And he wants to melt it all down.
Oh, okay.
And mint his own coin.
Uh-huh.
And him being the only person who has access to the gold gets to start off his new economy with him on top.
Right.
It's a very over the top James Bond thing.
For sure.
So for what it is trying to do on the level of the villains, it is succeeding.
Yeah.
Do you agree it's succeeding with the other henchmen, such as Areola Baccarat and the unnamed Frankenstein character who is clearly
named
supposed to be
Areola?
Yes.
Areola Baccarat.
You can guess her gender and appearance, no doubt.
Oh, and okay, so let's play this game.
I think so.
Pussy Galore. Oh, that's a Bond girl. Right, she's not from this movie. How about Dr. Goodhead? Yeah, that's pretty awful, but from a Bond movie.
Right.
And it's so much better than a lot of vagina, which is from Austin Powers 1, which I think is a good movie.
Yeah.
They're at least trying to be clever in their send-up to the Bond girl name.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. The Russian in this film, not played by a Russian, correct?
No, he's English, I'm pretty sure.
It's Roger Reese.
Okay, so it's Roger Reese.
You know him from Cheers.
I do know
Cheers,
Roger
Cheers, he's Robin Colcourt. I know. I can't see him as anything else.
I have a, yeah.
He's not supposed to be Russian. He is working with... He's like the English minister of finance.
Gotcha.
So he's not, you know, it's not like, hello, I'm from Russia, eh?
Gotcha. I see. All right, so we've got Michael Corbin is now, you know, the young kid, but he's mixed up in this. So do hijinks ensue?
Yes, they do. And what makes this movie so beautiful is Michael Corbin's an absolute dipshit. He does everything wrong. He's not a smooth character.
Okay.
He's not on top of things. He consistently makes bad decisions, giving lie to the idea of white male cis privilege. And that's what I loved about this movie. It takes the idea of put a white dude in a situation he will be the hero and explodes it. He does everything wrong and has to be saved by women time after time.
I'm sorry, what movie are you watching?
I know, seriously.
This movie is all about white male cis privilege. It takes really competent female characters and constantly pushes them aside for the two male leads who are both white cisgendered men.
So you're telling me Michael Corbin is a competent spy?
I'm saying the results always come out
Could
right.
Could you answer the question, Hansel? Is Michael Corbin a competent spy?
Let's not get
spy?
Too aggressive here. That's not the type of court that I'm holding, all right?
A lot of that he is a spy.
For like 50% of the movie, he's doing the job right, but not realizing that he's doing the job right. Which is exactly my point. He is somehow the star of this movie, whereas the female characters who are inadvertently helping him or like helping him but really not getting the credit for it are not getting the credit for this.
I agree with Dr. Bueller, but the problem is that he is our hero. He is the protagonist of this movie, and so it nonetheless glorifies his behavior. And he, in fact, wins out in the end in every situation.
I think it's very clear he wins out because of female aid, which is not clear in a lot of the James Bond movies. He doesn't win without the woman he teams up with who's looking for revenge. Without her, he doesn't win.
What is her name?
I don't remember anyone's name except for the French teacher. I got Corbin's first name wrong. I called him Richard Corbin.
She was so important that we don't remember her name.
Yeah.
But go on.
Gabrielle Anwar.
Thank you. Oh, I should have known that because she's from...
A Son of a Woman.
Yes.
Yes, you're also reading off the back of the box. I'd like to...
No, Son of a Woman is not on there.
No, we did have this conversation about who she was because she's one of four celebrities I've ever seen in real life. I saw her at the moment. I couldn't remember her name because I've got a drunk's memory. But he doesn't do anything without the help of the French teacher. And I really do like the fact that at the end, she's pivotal at the end about making sure crowd control
happens.
Yeah, she's
pivotal for five minutes
well,
of this movie.
Let me not try to fog my brain with the end when I'm still trying to decode it.
Don't worry, there's not much in between.
All right. Well, so on the back of the box, maybe you guys can just help me with this because I got some visuals here. I'm going to describe one of the two images that's on the back. There is Richard Grieco. It looks as though he's flat on his stomach, or nearly so, looking down at something, and just under the left side of him is what looks like a 12-year-old girl or something.
That's Gabrielle Anwar.
Okay. And then in the background, it seems to be like there's fire or something. For the sake of equality and fairness, I'm just going to indicate that image to everybody.
This is the big conclusion.
Oh, yeah. That's
the conclusion. After Grieco and Gabrielle Anwar have been captured and imprisoned in a medieval-esque castle.
So they figure out what the deal is?
Gabrielle Anwar tells Richard Grieco what the deal is.
And so do they get upset with him for being like a fake spy or something?
They don't figure that out.
Because and that's the thing.
Actually, he does point it out towards the end of the movie, and she's like, what? You don't have a plan? He's like, I'll come up with a plan.
Oh, well, so, he points that to her, but not to the villains or the government.
So who does he get imprisoned by? Or
Roger Reese, the bad dude.
Okay.
Starenko. Which, come on, what an awesome Bond villain name, Starenko.
I got you. So Roger Reese, then, is the villain of this spy group. So it seems like Roger Reese is, like, doing the right thing and catching the bad guy spies, or trying to. Is that true, or am I backwards on that?
Roger Reese is the villain.
Yeah,
he's trying to overthrow the world economy.
Roger Reese is the chairman of the European Finance Committee.
Okay.
And is killing other members of the European Finance Committee in order to take over Europe's gold supply.
So Michael Corbin, then, the people that think he's going to be a spy, they're actually good. Like, they want to overthrow Roger Reese. All right, I see.
The whole conceit is the British government loses their best agents.
Oh, I see.
Which is played by Roger Daltrey. Of the Who.
Of the Who?
Yes.
No kidding.
Yeah, he's got a little cameo.
Wow.
And so they want to get someone.
From Sliders.
They think that there's a mole, which there is, inside the British government. So they ask the help of the Americans to use the best, most covert CIA agent, which is why no one knows what Michael Corbin looks like and thinks that that's him, because no one knows what this guy looks like.
Okay.
So he's brought over, and they think, okay, that... And they make a comment, oh, well, he looks a bit young, but I guess, you know, if this is the guy...
Okay.
And I want to just go back to the choices he makes. I have a note here, and I think this is important.
Right.
It's not that he's making bad choices and being glorified for it. He's a teenager, and that's part of where the humor comes in. And he's every choice he makes is the choice a teenager would make in that situation. It really is like, well, what would happen if we made Goldfinger, except instead of a seasoned guy, it was this dipshit 17-year-old high school dropout.
Wasn't that James Bond Jr.? Okay, so that's at the end, then, that photo. There's one next to it in which Greco is holding a chain, and it seems like he's fighting a man with a golden hand, possibly arm. And I'm assuming that's Roger Reese?
No, that's the Frankenstein guy that John Rice was talking about.
Oh, okay. So that scene is not at the end?
It is at the end. Yes. Both those pictures are from the climax of the movie.
Oh, okay, great. Good to get that out of the way.
At this point, Greco's French class is being suspended over a pot of molten gold.
Okay.
And I like to point out, throughout the film, there's this delightful back and forth in a very Power Rangers style.
Oh, that's pandering. I have just...
overruled. I'll hear it.
I'm switching between the plot of the heroes versus the monsters with a very typical high school story. Just like, what's happening with these kids on the French trip?
Well, what is happening with the kids on the
French
trip?
They're getting mixed up in all sorts of nonsense.
They never leave the bus. They never leave the bus.
French trip.
That's not getting mixed up in anything.
I feel like I'm hearing two different movies here. So they don't leave the bus.
Never. Not until they are drafted. Put on that cage above that molten gold.
Okay. But that's the most successful gag in the whole film, because their bus drivers keep getting replaced by villains of escalating evilness, and they have no idea, because the driver of the bus is always an asshole, and like nobody cares about him.
They stop for a pee break, the driver goes out, he's killed by one of Steranko's guys. He comes back, because at this point, everyone thinks the French teacher is like a mercenary, and these kids, or the French group, or whatever, are her mercenary team.
Okay.
So everyone's keeping tabs on her. So they kill the driver, and then it's this big menacing guy of Steranko's, and he's like, hello. He says, in French, he says hello, and they're like, okay, bonjour, and they do the whole thing. And that happens like three times. Like, then the British government kills him and takes over.
And puts in a new driver, and it gets funnier every single time.
Yeah, that's about as funny as this movie gets.
Eventually, it's Frankenstein, and that's the apex of the humor in that gag.
All right. So clearly, though, the Frankenstein bites it, right? I mean, he in that scene... Doesn't look like he's gonna make it out of that. Like, so then
even you might have never seen a James Bond film in your life, but you heard about one.
Right.
That's about as much knowledge as you need to figure out the parody of this movie. In fact, if Greco's character had ever seen a James Bond film, they could have jumped forward 15 minutes in the film.
Interesting.
Clearly, this guy is the villain. He's playing Baccarat.
Okay. So then the.
Thank you, Jason.
I'm sorry, it does take a while, but that was a damn good joke.
So the fight with the Frankenstein dude, then it's not, it seems like it must come slightly before what must surely be some kind of showdown with Roger Reese. Does that happen?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, because I figure if he's the big bad, then you've got to take care of him, right? I mean, do they do that? Or does he...
He's exposed in front of the international community as...
No, that's after that, isn't it?
Well, he is exposed.
Right,
there's
but...
There's a ball.
It's after that moment
there's
of the...
Ball.
Oh, right.
It's after the fire.
Yeah, yeah, because you have to dispatch the big, you know, the big Jaws. Let's say, let's call Frankenstein Jaws instead. Right.
Except it's his hand instead of his mouth, so we can call him Hand.
Yeah. But you do see how the hand happens. Yeah. Unlike with Jaws, we don't see the dental know, work gone awry. But you've got to dispatch the muscle before you get to the head of the operation, which he does.
For sure. So, okay, so he gets revealed, and then does he die?
I'd like to point out one of the inaccuracy of the movies, because I watched this really recently and still don't still haven't figured out an answer. So Greco's character fights Hand on top of a pile of a big vat of smoldering gold in which he froze the top of using liquid nitrogen.
I can kind of see
that's what that picture is.
Gotcha.
Okay. So they fight, Hand falls into the, like, breaks through the surface like it's ice and falls in.
Alright.
Somehow that leads to a small explosion.
Okay.
I don't know why that causes an explosion.
Interesting.
Are people bombs? Does gold, you know, suddenly explode after you, like, crack the top of the frozen part?
If I can enter into the court at your pleasure.
Sure.
I want to set. I want to reference another case, the People versus Terminator 2, where they drop the T2 in and there are explosions all over the place.
Okay.
I mean, I'm assuming, I'm no scientist, but if a movie like Terminator 2, which has got its science down, as we all know, does it implies that maybe it has to do with the shifting temperatures.
Okay.
Like putting, like taking a cold turkey and putting it in a deep fryer.
Yeah, kind of where my mind went with it. Although I don't know. I mean, that's a good question.
Sometimes shit explodes.
Okay.
I mean, I think this movie often likes to place its spectacle over any sort of logic or coherence.
Kind of like a James Bond movie.
That's amazing. It's my favorite.
And it's really frustrating because of moments like that where you have these things that take you out of what otherwise would be an enjoyable fight scene, and you're like, why the fuck did the gold, liquid gold just explode? Like, what is combustible in liquid gold to make this fire that ultimately starts taking down the entire mansion in which they are located? And so I feel like there are a lot of those kinds of tiny inaccuracies that the prosecution might try to... I'm sorry, the defense, where I always get this. That the defense might try to paint as somehow quirky or charming or clever, but I think are really more just annoying and frustrating.
All right, but I understand.
Would you say the same thing about the same phenomenon in every James Bond movie? Like, you're watching GoldenEye, which is considered a solid James Bond movie. And at the very beginning, he defies physics by throwing himself down at an angle and beating a plane.
Right.
The plane goes off first, and he dives after it, and he somehow propels himself by himself to get into that plane and then pull it up. Yeah. That's not fucking possible. But do we sit here and say, well, all the James Bond movies are full of these ridiculous inaccuracies and they're unwatchable?
All right, I'm going to give you this.
You know what? Just for spite you, I'm picking Moonraker as my next one.
It's actually great. I will say that unlike the human centipede, this does not have to be 100% medically accurate. So we can go with some farcical stuff. But I'm still confused about what happens to Roger Reese. So is it...
All right, so if I may.
Please.
Unless anyone wants to.
No, go right in.
So,
I've forgotten so much of this movie.
So what happens is after he frees the French teacher and his French class and dispatches with Hand.
Okay.
That's great. He goes into this ballroom where Steranko is having a party with all of these different people that he pretty much was going to murder anyway.
Okay.
But because Richard Rico's character kind of like unmasked him, it accelerated his plan, which you know often happens in a Bond movie. And his whole plan, and this is a really cool scene, the way he unmasks him, is he's got everyone drinking champagne, and everyone but his has poisoned champagne.
Okay.
Right? And Greco kind of comes up behind him, and he says, hey, and he like takes his champagne and he gives him more someone else's, and he says, let's toast. And, and he won't toast. And then he gives the expository monologue about this is what's going on. Mm-hmm. And what proves Richard Rico isn't just some dipshit kid spouting off is that he will not toast with him, throws it down, and there's a gunfight, and he runs away.
Okay.
Right. And then explosions ensue. You know, you don't need to know everything.
And then the French teacher comes out, and she's got like a beret on, like she's Rambo, and she's got a semi-automatic. It's really
sad. She's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
She absolutely is, but it's still a great
gag. Pretty exciting.
Okay.
Oh God, it was terrible. It was terrible. Those awful people, and they killed that man. Michael, what is going on here? How did we even?
They tried to kill
all of us. Mrs. Grover, listen. There's no time to explain. But now you are the French teacher.
I understand.
Now get to the reception and don't let them drink the champagne.
Move out!
All right.
The French teacher is my favorite character in this movie.
Yeah, she's the Tom Berenger of this movie.
She is.
But didn't you say earlier that this was the French club and not the French class? And so,
well, she kind of, this is after like they're abducted, they're put in a cage, and they keep telling her, "Who are you? Who is the French teacher? What, you know, what's your mission?"
I see.
And they just keep berating her, and they won't listen to her that she's just an actual French teacher. Uh-oh. So this is her being freed and being like, you know, fuck that. Okay. I'm becoming the French teacher.
Oh, I see.
There's also a little bit of gaslighting going on, too, though, by, I think it's even the British agents who might have been the ones who were like, you don't know Michael Corbin. You don't know.
Okay.
They're kind of like gaslighting her. They're actually making her go a little insane. I think it's kind of
like
Charlotte Perkins' The Yellow Wallpaper.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
interesting.
Bring it back to literature, y'all.
Old school. Right.
Roger Reese just escapes.
He escapes to the roof, where he is trying to load up his gold coins that he has made into one helicopter.
Okay.
The building is starting to explode with more and more liquid gold in the basement.
Okay.
And then Richard Grieco and Anwar's characters get up to the roof, and they...
Shootout?
Yeah, they shoot the helicopter with machine guns.
Also explodes.
Okay. Which causes the money to fall out the bottom because they're such good shots, having never picked up guns before.
Okay.
And he and the gold fall out of the helicopter.
Oh, you're missing. Okay.
Yeah, of course. You know, I don't want to... You know, it's...
All right, well then, please add to the record.
I don't know if the subtlety is necessary.
Yes, exactly. No, because this is an interesting character moment that, again, paints this guy as your... I don't give a fuck even about my own people, Bond villains. Much like Christopher Walken in A View to a Kill, where he just pretty much puts bullets in everyone, including Grace Jones, who's been helping him the whole movie, because he's crazy. He's trying to lift up with Linda Hunt, and they won't get up. So the reason that Corbin's able to get a shot off is because the helicopter won't fucking go anywhere, because Bond physics isn't working for the villain.
Okay.
And
the one time they choose to do real physics.
Well, you know, there's Bond physics and there's real physics. Bond physics works for Bond, real physics works for the villain. So they can't get up, and so they're taking shots. And this guy is so filled with avarice that instead of throwing off a bag of gold, he kicks Linda Hunt off to lighten the load. Mm. And she uses her her lasso thing to kind of hang on, and he has like one last quip before he kicks her to her death. And then they wind up blowing up the helicopter. But it goes to show that the character's fatal flaw, his avarice, is what leads to his death. Because he could have escaped if he just threw a couple of bags off.
Right.
He has a hamartia. It's Shakespearean, really.
Right. I see this. So he dies in the explosion.
There's another explosion.
Yes, this gold just keeps exploding.
Yeah.
I mean,
the castle was on fire anyway. We knew that one was coming.
Okay, so then he doesn't die in the helicopter? He dies in the helicopter.
But then the castle explodes, and we're not sure if Richard Grieco and Gabriel Anwar are going to make
it. But of course they do.
But then they make it.
Of course. So they make it, and Roger Reese dies in the second helicopter explosion?
One of the explosions.
Does it really matter which
explosion
killed him?
It's going down anyway, right? I mean, that's just going to happen.
As helicopters do.
Well, they don't, but...
This is a private thing.
Yeah. Well, let me just tell you what I want to be true. What I want to be true, and you'll tell me if this is possibly true on a subtextual level. What I want to be true is that I want Michael Corbin to have had an epically terrible childhood, and his father then at the beginning is basically the Roger Reese that comes out later, and then by defeating Roger Reese, he's defeated his father. That is what I want to be true. Is that true?
This movie is not nearly as deep as what you just said.
Nowhere near as deep.
Okay.
But you were saying how horrible his father was and how abusive his upbringing was, and now you're backpedaling because it's what Your Honor wants to hear.
No way that they're bringing that as any kind of correlation between the father and Roger Reese.
He follows through.
That's what it is.
He learns to follow through.
But he doesn't defeat his father.
Yeah. There's no setting up of that whatsoever.
It's kind
of
worked out. You could make an argument, and I'm not saying I believe this argument, but it's my job. You could make the argument that the father's biggest problem at sending his son away by spending the money is also the shared avarice, but magnified, of Starenko.
But the avarices are different, pointed at different things. Plus, this is just some spoiled rich kid who wants to go off to college in the fall.
He's not rich. His dad paints. He's a working class kid.
We don't know if his dad paints or not.
We just care. Is he a performance artist?
He is. There is that little to go on.
It is his father's love that enables his heroism. Plus, Power Rangers. Because without his father's love and sacrifice, he never would have gone to France and discovered that he could, in fact, follow through, even in situations that were way over his head.
Oh, but his father seems to kind of put that forward in a little bit of an insulting way, right? I mean,
well, his son failed out of high school.
He failed one class. He failed one class.
He wasn't going to graduate.
By the way, you're talking to someone who almost did not graduate high school for failing gym class, so...
But you did.
Careful, Mark. Okay. All right, I see. So it's much more superficial than trying to draw any parallels between, you know, this villain and a potential emotional villain in his life.
I think his
like
father
that.
Gives him the strength to overcome Roger Reese.
Well, I mean, that is true. The whole speech, he's doing this to follow through. That's a through line. It's set up by the father, and it comes to an end when he actually not only defeats Starenko, but escapes the castle on his own cognizance. He comes in. It's a blossoming person. He's a teenager coming into his own as a man.
Coming of age story.
It's a coming. It's exactly
a story. A building's roman, and this thing, especially if by the end our hero, who is now a man, is saying things like, "Hey, your dick's on fire. Made you look."
Well, that's just
so
funny.
Well, thank you for saying that. Because that does indicate to me possibly more of a short-term solution here. That perhaps he did follow through on this thing, but on other things such as, you know, paying taxes or going to therapy, he might not.
Dick extinguishing. Yeah.
Well, maybe this is the origin story of Daniel Craig's James Bond. This is James Bond. All right, fine. Roger Moore's James Bond. All right.
Hey,
you gotta give me that. Fucking Roger Moore. Look, I sat through
Roger Moore at least has class. God.
But I'm sure he didn't. This was Roger Moore when he was 17, 18. Kind of a lout. Kind of like a dipshit idiot who maybe is a bit spoiled.
Oh, I agree the character's a dipshit idiot.
we never argued he wasn't. That's the charm
That's
of it. He's a high school student.
That's what makes the movie work, is he's a dipshit idiot.
Who comes into his own, and by the end he's Roger Moore.
I would have to disagree. I think it glorifies jock culture. I mean, there's a lot of degrading of nerds. There's one of the slurs is Nerd Patrol, I remember him was calling. And his friend along the trip is this really burnout guy named... it's Pauly Shore. It's got to be Pauly Shore. It's not Pauly Shore.
Well, if he's so important, why don't you remember his name?
Because he's not fucking important. That's why.
I barely remember all your names.
But it's glorifying jock culture, and hand in hand with that, it's incredibly degrading to women. I mean, in terms of all the treatment of the women, especially how the Pauly Shore character sitting on the bus next to a woman, one of his classmates who's sleeping, and he tries to lean over and lick her ear as she's sleeping, which is one of the creepiest things I think that's ever been preserved on film, and I just wish I could remove that image. That's the one thing that my brain chooses to remember from this movie. I don't know why everything else is left, but that's the one image that remains.
Thanks for bringing it up, Brian.
Sorry. Oh my god, Brian, your dick's on fire!
Still not funny.
So, alright, final question before I deliberate. If this movie had an action figure line, would it be cool?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Why? And all why?
Right. You mean, would get the gold whippy thing?
You would get, if
that'd
I may.
Fun?
Which would never work, actually.
You would get Linda Hunt with gold whipping action.
Okay.
Just the fact you're getting the fucking principal from Kindergarten Cop as an action figure.
Okay.
Done. You would get the Michael Corbin... Richard Grieco, and if you acted soon, if you did the mail away, you would also be able to spin his head off and put on the actual adult Michael Corbin and gets killed, right? You'd get a 2-in-1.
Oh, I see.
You would get Gold Hand, right?
With removable hands.
With removable hands.
His name is Hand.
But it's a gold hand. Right. You'd get
Roger Reese doing nothing.
But you could also use him in your Cheers play set as Robin Coldcore.
That's a good point.
And think of the accessories. Like there was a Q branch thing here. He gets X-ray specs, an explosive gun, sticky soled '90s high tops, which
and some sort of condom that explodes.
Actually, that there wasn't the condom that exploded. Somebody shot a bazooka into his bedroom.
I took a note that says combat condom.
It did say combat condom. That was not what exploded.
Oh, I see. Oh.
Well, the X-ray glasses he uses to immediately start looking at women's
and then
chests.
Later
as
at the background table, the film makes a very transphobic joke.
Oh, it does.
When he looks over to one woman who is sitting at the table, and then he realizes is a man. And then gets all, icky and,
out.
He's like, oh, no, that's horrible. Ah. Okay. All right.
I mean, that's an awful joke. But again, it's a joke of its time. I'm not saying it's okay.
Yeah, 1991 was just...
We are talking to the person who defended Jingle All the Way.
Okay.
And that had a lot of dicey stuff.
Okay.
And, it was of its time. Well, and the judge.
No, I did.
Also.
I did. You're right. Okay. Thank you. I have a lot to think about.
Closing statements?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yes, close it up.
Well, I just think it has a really 90s sensibility that you would appreciate, and I also feel that its deconstruction of the male action hero is progressive in its way. And Richard Grieco has really great eyebrows in it. So.
Okay.
And Richard Grieco... So I'm sorry.
Wow. Can you hear me rolling my eyes?
It sounds like the Tin Man pre-oil, John. That was some heavy eye rolling.
Thank you.
I really think that this movie set out to do a clever parody of the James Bond movies in particular. Mm-hmm. And I think it did it. You had the over-the-top supervillain, the over-the-top henchman. Mm-hmm. You had so many allusions to a lot of different Bond movies, which I've been watching, so they're fresh in my mind.
Yeah.
You have the Q branch scene. We didn't even get into when he gets the James Bond car, where that's the only reason he takes on the spy gig. Mm-hmm. Because that's what a teenager would do. He's like, no, guys, I'm not a spy. They show him the supercar, and he's like, so if I say I'm the spy, I can get out of here with this? And you see a teenager pretty much destroy the James Bond car, because that's what teenagers do to cars. It is making a comment on teenage idiocy. It is, hinting at a coming-of-age story, but more than any of that, it is accomplishing what it set out to do, which is to be a fun, competent James Bond send-off, which other movies have tried and failed miserably, and if I have to pick Goldmember to prove my point next time, I will.
Okay, great.
As tempted as I am to not watch Goldmember ever again, I'm going to proceed with this statement.
I like gold!
I'd like to read, to start off, if I can,
a
list of spy parodies.
I thought that was a tone poem about you.
Movies that do the James Bond parody thing much, much better than this film.
Okay, great.
Casino Royale. Yeah. Agent 8 3/4.
Surely, right.
Yes.
That was terrible, by the way.
I've seen it.
Stop it, Jason. Armand Flint. Arabesque. Le Magnifique.
The Spy with the Gold Nose, burn after reading. What's Up, Tiger Lily? Never Say Never Mind. Carry On Spying, Our Man in Havana. Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machine.
Oh, come on! Get the fuck out of here, that's better.
Much funnier. Hopscotch, Top Secret. Kiss the Girls and Make Them Die. O.K. Connery, starring Sean Connery's younger brother.
Wow.
Come Spy With Me, Austin Powers, Spy Hard, and yes, Get Smart. There are so many better ways to enter parody with James Bond and spy films. This film is just really, really tired. It's tired, it's got nothing new to add to this, and it's just kind of dull as dishwater. The characters are flat.
What are you saying about my dishwater?
I'm sure your dishwater is delightful. It has absolutely nothing to say. Even its premise of this gold member-like premise... Sorry, I'm mixing these up. Goldfinger-like premise of taking over the world's gold doesn't even hold up a couple of years after its conception.
Oh.
Like, uniting all the Europe's gold supply? That's called the Euro. They do it a couple of years from now, and by blowing up the palace with all the Euro gold into it, actually achieves Goldfinger's goal much better than Goldfinger would have. Mm. They destroyed a large amount of gold by making it explosive somehow.
Mm.
It's just kind of stupid.
Okay. Just kind of
Brian,
stupid.
Brian, anything to add?
No, I think you summed it up very well, John. The fact that it is a James Bond spoof does not make it a good James Bond spoof. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We're tired, too.
I wish I could remember more of it. So.
Great. Well, thank you so much, and I'm going to think about this right now. Ladies and gentlemen, I've peed on this and I have a verdict. I fully appreciate the arguments on both sides. Each team made, I think, an excellent case. You know, highlights for me included when you guys talked about the action figures. I was totally on board with that. You know, the other side talking about issues of transphobia and you know, all those types of concerns very much had my heart. At the end of the day, I'm ruling against this movie. I'm ruling against it for several reasons that touch very close to my heart. The first part of it is just unresolved issues with one's father. I think
that's part of the movie.
Well, that's unfortunate. if it were, I probably would have enjoyed it, or at least enjoyed the recap of it. The second part is, I believe your point about pandering to sort of a jock culture and making it seem in some way funny or cool, and in fact, it destroys lives. At the end of the day, while I will say that I probably would buy those action figures as described, I do have to rule against the movie on those grounds, which are just too emotionally close to where I live. So thank you both to the two teams. Again, outstanding job with amazing points on both sides. It was close, but that's the verdict.
All right, well, this is obviously retribution because I hanged Jingle All the Way. But I want to throw it out there to see what everyone else thinks, our dear listeners. So, dear listeners, take a look at this movie and get back to us. Tell us if you agree or disagree with the Honorable Judge Jonathan Alexandrides' ruling to hang this movie till it was dead. Give it a extra pest sentence, Jonathan. What would you... I actually out and out killed your movie. What would you do to this one?
I would sentence it to Eternal Gym Class.
Ooh.
Oh. Yeah, that's what I would
do. That's a good one.
Nice. Yeah.
All right. So if you agree or disagree with Jonathan and the Honorable Jonathan Alexandrides' sentencing of If Looks Could Kill to a lifetime or an eternity of gym class, please tweet at us at Movies on Trial, and let us know your thoughts. Also, maybe you're not the tweeting type. I don't often twit. Then you can email us at moviesontrial12@gmail.com. That's all one word, moviesontrial12@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate and review us at iTunes. The ratings can only help our listenership. And that really is what it's all about, the listenership. You guys. John, would you like to give the audience a little parting words?
I would just say, be kind to yourselves and each other. Please remember to spay and neuter your pets.
You're all frightened.
As well you should be.
Not since the Protestant Catholic Wars in the 16th century has Western society known anything remotely comparable to the subcontinent's religious malevolence. To a lesser observer, the intensity of the emotional frenzy is so illogical as to border on mass psychosis. But as has been said by kings and queens, I am not a lesser observer. And I looked and I beheld a pale horse, and the name that sat on him was Death, and Hell followed with him.